Die Tokio Olimpiese Spele is eersdaags op ons televisieskerms. Van 23 Julie tot 8 Augustus gaan ons kyk hoe atlete deelneem teen mekaar. Hierdie Olimpiese Spele is om 3 redes anders as enige vorige Olimpiese Spele. Nommer 1, dit moes al in 2020 plaasgevind het en is met 'n jaar uitgestel. Nommer 2, daar gaan geen toeskouers wees nie. En nommer 3, dit is die eerste keer in die geskiedenis van die Olimpiese Spele dat 'n transgender atleet, Laurel Hubbard, aan 'n item gaan deelneem en sy gaan wel deelneem aan 'n sekere kategorie binne die gewig optel items. Nou is die vraag, is dit regverdig dat 'n transgender atleet in die vroue kategorie deelneem teen ander vroue? Het sy 'n voordeel bo ander vroue of het sy nie 'n voordeel bo ander vroue nie? En my gas vandag is Dr. Ross Tucker. Hy's 'n baie bekende sportwetenskaplike. Hy gaan probeer om vir ons lig te werp op hierdie baie moeilike kwessie. Want op die ou einde is die vraag, wat is wetenskaplik korrek en aanvaarbaar en wat is polities korrek en aanvaarbaar? Want die twee kan nie op dieselfde bladsy geskryf word nie. Dr. Tucker, kom ons vergeet vir eers van transgender. Kom ons sê, waarom is daar twee kategorieë, mans en vroue?
So in sport, I think everyone would appreciate that there are differences between men and women in terms of performance. And those differences are so large that if we didn't have a category for women, and it needs to obviously be protected and closed so that only women participate in it, sport would lose its meaning for them. And the reason I say that is that the differences between the best males and the best females, so let's take the 100 meters, for instance, at the Tokyo Olympics, we'll crown a men's 100 meter champion and a woman's 100 meter champion. And we do that because we recognize that they are equal and both worthy of gold medals, but they are different. And they're different to the extent of about 10 to 12%, which means that the men's champion will run 100 meters about 10 or 11% faster than the women's champion. That's the same as the difference you'll see in the swimming pool in Tokyo. The best 200 meter freestyler for men will be 10 to 12% faster than the best freestyler for females. When we look at some other events where upper body strength is important, the differences are even larger. So in weightlifting, for instance, even when you look within the same weight category, the men are lifting between 30 and 40% heavier than the women are. So those differences are enormous, and they necessitate that a separate category exists for women. As I said, if you didn't have that separate category, women would basically disappear from sport, because there are literally thousands, and that's not an exaggeration, there are thousands of men, males, who can outperform the best female. For instance, in the 100 meters again, the Olympic champion of 2016 is beaten every single year by about 2,000 men's performances. And that includes 15, 16-year-old boys and includes 45-year-old men. So the male advantage in sport is what creates the need for a protected category for women who don't have that advantage. And just a short word on categories. There are many instances in sport where we have categories. Think about boxing. You have heavyweights, you have middleweights, and you have lightweights. And what they're doing there is they're protecting fairness and safety for smaller boxers. Because if you didn't do that, the bigger boxer, all other things being equal, would always win. So categories are important in sport because they create integrity and fairness and safety. And the male-female difference is the same. So the female category creates fairness and integrity for women athletes.
Dr. Tucker, is daar enige sport waar mans en vroue gelykwaardig teen mekaar kan deelneem, waar die man nie 'n biologiese voordeel bo die vrou het nie?
At the Olympic Games, the only one where there is performance equality or parity is equestrian events. And so you'll see that is the one Olympic event where they award a single medal, because there's no difference there between males and females. There are other sports where the difference might be smaller. So for instance, shooting and archery. But the difference in strength that I've mentioned that males have over females still creates a small performance difference between them, even in those sports. So the short answer is yes, but one or two. And the specific answer is that in the Olympic Games, With that exception, there are none.
Dr. Tucker, wat is die hoofrede vir hierdie groot verskil in prestasie tussen 'n man en 'n vrou?
So physiologically, there are a number of drivers or factors that create performance differences. And so it's a little bit oversimplified to say it like this, but the primary driver, the main thing that causes that difference is the hormone testosterone. Most people would have heard of testosterone. It's a hormone that belongs to a family of hormones called androgens. And the word androgen literally means male making. And anyone listening to this who's got children will probably have seen this, is that when children are 9, 10, 11 years old, boys and girls can play sport together. They are more or less physically equal. Not exact. And the best boys are probably still 1 to 3% faster and stronger than the best girls. But it's close enough that, you know, they can play soccer and rugby and whatever else together. But once boys hit about 13, things change. And that change is driven by testosterone. And so, for instance, it causes what we recognize as male characteristics. Now, some of those are not relevant to sport, like deepening of the voice and hair growth. But others are. So, for instance, we get less fat, we get more muscle. The shape of the skeleton changes. The heart and the lungs increase in size. And those things are very important for sports performance. And so from about the age of 13, 14, there is this separation in performance driven mainly by testosterone, which then causes this gap that I've mentioned, 10 to 12% for speed, 30% for power, 30 to 50% for strength. And again, that's why we have a category for women to protect against that male testosterone-driven advantage.
Met hierdie gegewe, wat is die voordeel wat 'n transgender vrou het bo ander vroue atlete? Met ander woorde, iemand wat gebore is as 'n man, maar deur verskeie operasies en behandelings nou 'n vrou is. Bo 'n vrou wat gebore is as 'n vrou.
This is the million-dollar question, and I think it's been known in sport going back 20 years that this was going to happen. Because, very briefly, transgender women are people who are biologically male and went through the development that I've just mentioned. So during their growth and development, they had testosterone, and they can use that testosterone. So they develop these male attributes, but then because they identify as women and they want to compete in women's sport, the International Olympic Committee had to sit down and say, well, can we do this? And I think you can understand why they did this, but they basically said, all right, if the reason for the male advantage is testosterone, then what we can do is we can fix the problem by asking these trans women to lower their testosterone levels, and then the advantage will go away. So the principle behind current policy is if you take the testosterone level away, then you take the advantages away. And that's what allows someone like Hubbard to compete in women's weightlifting, is because she would have lowered her natural testosterone levels for a period of 12 months below a certain level. So really the question that then has to be asked is, does it work? In other words, is it true that if I lower my testosterone, my male advantages disappear? Now, this is where it gets a little bit complex, because there are 13 studies that have been done in trans women measuring things like muscle mass, muscle strength, bone density. And in general, they find that lowering the testosterone removes only a small portion of that male difference. So, for instance, where males have 30% to 50% more strength, lowering testosterone only takes about 5 to 10% away. Lowering testosterone doesn't take away bone density and strength. Lowering testosterone doesn't take away muscle mass. It still leaves most of it behind. So the conclusion from those studies is that most of the male advantages, which occur as a result of testosterone, persist even after the testosterone is lowered. So I can't give you an exact answer, because it's never been measured in trans women athletes in terms of how large is the advantage. But what we do know is that the original male advantage is only removed to a small degree by the lowering of testosterone. And therefore, there must be significant retained advantages, and that's why this is controversial.
Dink jy dit is regverdig teenoor ander vroue atlete dat 'n transgender atleet in dieselfde kategorie deelneem as hierdie ander vroue atlete?
No, because unless you can show conclusively that you can take away all those male advantages, then a person who comes into the women's category from the male category is going to carry with them advantages that are unavailable to women. And that's really important. So if the fundamental or the foundational premise here is that women's sport exists for performance integrity, fairness, and safety, then that category has to be protected. And you have to have a way to exclude people who don't belong in it. And allowing biological males in without absolutely convincingly showing that they have taken away all the male advantage means that women's sport is undermined. And so I can't see fairness. And of course, weightlifting is one thing, but in other sports, contact sports and combat sports, I also can't see safety. So my impression is that sports have got a number of responsibilities. One of them is fairness. One of them is safety. Then there's inclusion. It would be nice for sport to be inclusive and allow anyone to compete, but you can't make exceptions that compromise the other two. So at some point, sport has to choose. Does it want fairness, safety, or does it want inclusion? And again, you just ask the parallel, would you allow a heavyweight to fight a lightweight if they didn't lose the weight? Well, of course not, because it violates the integrity of that lightweight category. So for me, the same is true here. Unless that biological male advantage is completely removed, and we know this beyond any doubt, I can't see how fairness can be guaranteed to women.
Is daar 'n geval waar atletiekbase verkies om polities korrek te wees en insluitend te wees teenoor transgender mense as om regverdig te wees teenoor ander vroue atlete en na die wetenskap te luister?
Yes, it is. And the IOC themselves, when they had a meeting in 2015, one of the members of that medical commission actually is quoted as saying that we have to move with the times. We have to recognize the importance of inclusion and societal pressures. So there is an element of that. And it's not necessarily a bad thing for sport to want to reflect broader society. So, you know, in a societal sense, people should be allowed to and respected for identifying as they wish. It's absolutely no problem with that. But in sport, what it does is it creates a colliding rights issue, because person A's rights to identify as a woman, as a trans woman, collides with person B's rights to compete in a closed category for women. So now all of a sudden you've got to weigh one thing up against another. So the mistake, I think, in my opinion, that sport made is that they try to balance them. They try to say, all right, we can achieve some inclusion, some fairness. But you can't. You can't balance these things, because if you go for inclusion, you compromise fairness. And if you go for fairness, you can't have inclusion. So they, in a way, messed it up by trying to accommodate everyone. And ultimately, it wasn't fair on biological females.
Is daar al ander vroue atlete wat nou in opstand kom of rebelleer teenoor die feit dat transgender vroue wat nou beslis 'n voordeel bo hulle het, ook in dieselfde item, in dieselfde kategorie, as hulle kan deelneem?
There is now. It's one of the interesting things is 4 or 5 years ago, when the situation was really the same, and I think most people who were involved in this area could see the situation developing, but the voice of women was left out of the conversation. Even when the IOC sat down to develop these guidelines, they had a group of men and a trans woman. And there were literally, I'm not exaggerating, no biological females, no women on that panel to discuss it. And so I think they were marginalized from the discussion early on. But what's happened in the last 2 to 3 years, and it's definitely been noticeable, is that more and more groups and more advocates for women's rights have started to become involved in the discussion. And there are now numerous petitions to the IOC that are circulating, asking them, in fact, demanding that they change the policy. But one of the things that has been quite noticeable is that women are scared, especially the athletes. A paper came out about 2 weeks ago in England where a group of Olympic athletes had been surveyed anonymously. And almost all of them said that they've got strong opinions, but they will not express them because they're scared they lose sponsorships. They're scared of the public backlash. They're scared of the abuse that they'll receive for speaking up against it. And it's, again, it's the situation where I think society wants to respect people's choices. But in sport, it's a domain where, as I said, you create this collision of rights. And people are very scared to talk about their rights because the backlash is so pronounced. It's a very unpleasant, emotive debate sometimes. So women are scared, but they are speaking.
Wat is die oplossing of hoe moet die pad vorentoe lyk?
This is an unsolvable problem if your solution needs to keep everyone happy. You can't do it. I just cannot see a solution that enables everyone here, and by everyone we're talking trans women on the one side of the debate and biological females on the other. Unfortunately, the reality physiologically is that once testosterone has done its job, you can't unwind it. You can take away some of it, but you can't undo biology. And so I don't see that the advantages will ever be taken away. And so then it becomes less about balancing and trying to find compromise as it does about just making a decision. Sport has to decide, is fairness its main priority or is inclusion the main priority? Now, if they go with inclusion, they're going to sacrifice fairness. And if they go with fairness, then you can't have inclusion. But I can't see what you can do to biology to change male physiology into female physiology. Maybe some events like long distance running, for instance, where strength and power and muscle mass are not as important. It's more about endurance and fatigue resistance. Maybe sports like that will one day be able to be fully integrated and inclusive. Maybe sports like archery and shooting, where the male advantage is smaller. But in all other sports where this male advantage is large, I just cannot see how inclusion can coexist with fairness. And so sport has to make a courageous decision to choose one or the other. It's the only way to do this. If you have a category to protect fairness and integrity for people who are lacking some attribute, whether it's a lightweight who lacks size and strength and power in boxing, or whether it's biological females who lack testosterone benefits, then you have to protect the category. Otherwise, you undermine the entire fabric of sport for that whole group of people. Maybe what happens in 20 years from now is that there are enough trans women that there can be a separate category or event for them. But I doubt it. I don't think that that's the case. And also don't think they want that. So again, no solution.
Ek kan nie help om nou ook aan Caster Semenya te dink nie. Nou, dis baie belangrik om onderskeid te maak, sy is nie 'n transgender vrou nie, maar sy het onvolledige of gedeeltelike androgene insensitiviteit. Dit beteken omtrent 1 uit 50.000 babas, XY babas, wat eintlik seentjies moet wees, het nie voldoende testosteron reseptore nie. En daarom kan haar nie genoeg testosteron bind nie en kan die baba nie uiterlike manlike organe ontwikkel nie. Nou dis heeltemal iets anders as iemand wat eers 'n man was en nou 'n vrou geword het. Maar dit beteken ook dat haar testosteron vlakke verhoog is al as hierdie verhoogde vlakke nie alles nuttig nie of bruikbaar vir haar nie. Maar dit is interessant dat die atletiekbase besluit het dat in sekere items, soos die 400 en die 800, moet sy haar testosteron vlakke verlaag om te mag deelneem, maar in die 5000 meter en ander items is het nie nodig dat sy dit hoef te verlaag nie. Is dit dan nie dat mense met verhoogde testosteron vlakke voordele het bo ander in alle items nie?
It's interesting that the policy for trans women, like Lowell Hubbard, is actually the same as the policy for athletes with DSDs like Caster Semenya, in the sense that the authorities are trying to fix the problem and take away the advantage by lowering the testosterone. So she's not, but the situation you've picked up on is the absurd outcome of a clumsy legal and scientific process, because it is outrageous to think that the same person can be legal on a Friday because they're running in a 200 meter race, and then illegal on a Saturday because they want to run a 400. We know that the difference between men and women is the same in those events. And so testosterone doesn't discriminate by event. That's the point. But they've got this really clumsy policy, and it shares certain principles with the trans issue, but it also shares some important differences. It's important to not necessarily conflate the two.
Is daar verdere studies nodig om te sien hoe transgender vroue se sportprestasies dalk beter is as die van ander vroue?
There's actually quite a lot of research on transgender women and transgender men, because medically, when people undergo these reassignments and either lower their testosterone levels or increase them, there are quite important medical questions to study. So, as I said, there are 13 longitudinal, this is where they track them over time into the future, studies, and they're ongoing. Those are the studies that I mentioned earlier where they found that if you lower the testosterone level, you only take away a small part of the initial strength, muscle mass, bone density advantages. What is lacking is a well-conducted study on trans athletes. So, for instance, Laurel Hubbard, nobody has ever done a study taking a group of 15 athletes like Hubbard, lowering their testosterone as biological males, and then measuring performance every 6 months for 4 or 5 years. There are currently a handful of places in the world that are trying to do that research. It's very difficult work to do. And so I think by the next Olympic Games, there'll probably be more data on this. But I don't know if it's going to be conclusive, but it's certainly happening a lot more. And it will happen because there's going to be a big need for it. You know, one of the things that's happening around the world is that the number of trans women is increasing all the time. So it wouldn't surprise me by 2024 if there are between 6 and 10 athletes like Hubbard in those Olympic Games.
Ras, heeltemal 'n ander vraag. Waarom is dit so dat 'n atleet wat baie goed presteer in 800 meter nie noodwendig 'n toppresteerder gaan wees in die 5000 meter nie?
The main difference between those is the intensity. So an 800 meter run is pretty close to sprint pace. It's not obviously flat out sprinting, but it's close to it. And when we exercise at that intensity, energy demand has to be met from different sources. Now, the problem with non-oxidative or oxygen-independent energy sources is that they create a lot of metabolic byproducts. So, for instance, your hydrogen ions accumulate, lactate concentration goes up, phosphate levels go up. This is all happening at the molecular level inside our muscles. And so an 800-meter runner is actually biochemically and molecularly quite different from a 5,000-meter runner. And that's why the two disciplines don't translate or cross over very well, because your 800-meter athlete doesn't have the ability to produce energy oxidatively for a long time, and your 5,000-meter athlete doesn't have the ability to produce energy fast enough from those oxygen-independent sources or to deal with those metabolic waste products. So whilst they can try one another's events and be okay at it, they'll never be world-class in both.
En dan is daar natuurlik die Tour de France. En men sien op die televisie hoe hierdie fietsryers deur prachtige landskappe ry. Dink jy dit is net oefening wat hulle so sterk maak? Of dink jy daar's nog steeds middels betrokke wat hulle prestasie verbeter?
I wish I could say that the doping problems of cycling have been solved, but I just don't think that that's the case, unfortunately. The reason I say that is that, you know, if we go back to the 1990s, that was probably the peak of doping in cycling. And then in 1998, 99, there were police investigations, there were raids. Everyone said, this is the turning point. From now on, cycling will be clean. And then, of course, we got Lance Armstrong. So we know how that story ended. So that was the 2000s, was Lance. And then in about 2007, 8, 9, things started to look a bit different. There were new anti-doping tools, and they said, right, well, this is going to be the turning point. Now we're going to have clean cycling. But in the 2010s, there's just been one story after another about cyclists' dodgy behaviors. Like Team Sky, for instance, recently was investigated, and their doctor has been struck off the registry for ordering testosterone. There've been failed tests among some of the top teams, top riders. And one of the other problems is that the sport still has so many of the characters from those bad 1990s days. You know, the guys who used to cycle in the 1990s are now team managers and coaches in the 2010s, 2020s. I haven't seen enough to persuade me that the sport is now clean. If I can be optimistic, I'd say that it is cleaner than it was maybe 5-10 years ago. But I'm highly doubtful that it's clean. And I think what's happened is that doping has evolved. You know, back in Armstrong's day, it was blood bags, it was EPO, it was testosterone. I think nowadays they can get away with less, but they've become more intelligent and they're using medical products. They're using asthma drugs that they don't need, cortisone, and they're combining all these clever drug combinations and mixtures to ultimately create the same success. So I guess depending on whether you're a glass half full or half empty person, you could say it's better than it used to be, or you can say it's still doped and therefore not clean and untrustworthy. It is a fantastic spectacle. I love these 3 weeks in July. And even knowing that what I'm seeing is probably not pure, I still enjoy it. It's one of those things where you must enjoy it, but don't ask how it's made.
Die tyd het ons ingehaal en ons moet groet. Baie dankie aan Dr. Ras Takker, bekende sportwetenskaplike, vir die baie interessante inligting wat hy met ons gedeel het. Gaan kyk gerus op ons webblad, daar is meer agtergrond inligting en moenie vergeet om volgende week in te skakel op Gesondheid op RSG nie. Ek gesels dan met Dr. Glenda Gray oor die vaksine. Want daar is baie vrae daaroor en ons gaan kyk wat ons kan opklaar. Tot volgende week dan. Groete van my, Marie Hudson.